Talk radio just got a little cooler.
Chad Benson.
Chad Benson.
The Chad Benson Show.
By the way, it is National Law Enforcement Appreciation Day. You see an officer out there. And look, we all know, as I tweeted out earlier, cops have a tough job. And when they see us, rarely is it at our best, because usually they've pulled us over and we've done something wrong, and or the perception of something wrong, and we are not happy. But it is, you know, it's a tough job. And it's a tough, I mean, case in point today, look what's taking place out in Orlando. We got our affiliate out there, WDBO. Yet again, another police officer shot and killed. 42-year-old Master Sergeant Clayton was killed today. And there's a manhunt everywhere. It is a horrible day. It's something about Florida, right? There's just something about Florida. You see Anthony's face. He's like, there's just something about it. But a horrible, horrible, horrible situation. And, you know, I mean, this is, and there, by the way, they have two deaths today, because another police officer died, I guess, from responding to the manhunt for the killer of Master Sergeant Deborah Clayton. So it's a horrible day, but it is a tough job out there. And I think we can recognize that. And every once in a while we can give some cops, you know, a little step back. I think law enforcement is look, like everything in life, you know, you give as good as you get. And law enforcement has earned some of the disdain that the people have towards them. They have. I'm not going to lie to you. Law enforcement, you know, growing up in Southern California, remembering the riots, but remembering what it was like with Rampart Division and the scandals that went on there and the way that things happened. There are some things in the past that have definitely happened. But I think we have cleared a lot of that out. Not to say that there's not a bad cop here or there. Just like not to say there's not a bad doctor, a bad nurse, a bad radio host, a bad egg everywhere, right? You know, bad teachers. It happens. But I'm just saying, you know, we can take a step back every once in a while and recognize what they're doing, what they're going through. And, you know, wish them Godspeed and say thank you. It's that simple. It's that easy. You know, Trump's getting ready to take over here. And today he named his son-in-law, I guess, some sort of special advisor. And I ain't quite, Jared, you know, Kushner's going to be some sort of advisor to Trump. And people are like, oh, my God, this is, you know, look, he's not getting paid. He's doing it for free. It doesn't bug anything. Stop the freaking out about it, people on the left and people on the right and people anywhere, because it doesn't matter. You couldn't pick this kid out of a lineup. He's probably 1,000 times smarter than all of us. Dude's pretty damn brilliant. He's made a ton of money. Smart cat. Really, hey, look, he's not a great looking dude, and he landed Mrs. Trump, right? He landed Ivanka. So it's a good thing. He's got to have something going for him. So can just, you know, slow everybody's roll. Slow the roll. The Republicans are screaming and yelling about the trillions of dollars of debt, right? Federal debt's way too high. I think we can all agree about that. And we're not just talking about the federal debt. Let's not even pretend to think about the unfunded liabilities that we have in the federal debt. But let's think about what we have in front of us. How many trillions of dollars? Well, they're considering a measure, and this is scary, that would appropriate levels of the debt to a point where it could rise from its current $20 trillion to $29.1 trillion in 10 years. I don't like that. I don't like that. And when I argue with people about government and the size of government, I always tell everybody, you know, because the conservative argument is I want smaller government. Really what we want is government out of our lives, right? I mean, that's really what we want. We think if there's less government, they're less apt to mess with us. And as we all know, that's not true. Secondly, and I think this is extremely important when it comes to government, is I want competent government. I'm over, I want small government. I want competent government. That's what I want. We're never going to shrink the size. By the way, every Republicans grow it too. Reagan grew it. Bush grew it. And dare I say, I think Trump has a chance to stem some of the tide, but I bet you it still grows underneath him. In truth, we want what from our government? We want him to stay out of our way. And I want you to be competent. I want you to spend our money wisely. I want you to protect the hell out of us. I want competent government. I want you to enforce the laws that need to be enforced. But can we stop pretending that if magically tomorrow we shrunk the government by half, that they're going to be competent? Government works slow now. I couldn't even imagine what it's like if you shrunk it. Competence. Why does it have to be about the size of the government? Why can't it be about the actual competency of the government? That's what we need. That's what I want. I want the competency of this government to be good. I want us to have, you know, real checks and balances. I want us to have facts and not feelings. I want us to not throw money blindly away. I want us to do the right things. And I want them to stay out of my life. That's the biggest. I want them to stay out of my life. But I'm also a realist, knowing that the government's not going to stay out of our life. The government's not going to stop being the government because you and I and everybody else are sick and tired of them spying on us or sick and tired of them overreaching. We, you know, that's why I say the best thing for you to do in situations like this is hyper focus on the areas that you live. You have a better chance of getting them off your back than you do the federal government. The federal government's not going anywhere. It is big. It is bulky. The best we can hope for is that somehow we get it somewhat lean and mean and start to return back to the way we once were, or at least stem the tide and slow it down rather than add to it. But the Republicans can talk all they want about how they want to be, you know, deficit hawks and how they want to cut the deficit and the debt and how they want to do all these kind of things, but they're just as bad because remember, their goal, when you become a congresswoman or congressman or senator, your goal is to serve the people and yourself. Meaning, yes, I'm here to serve you. And what can I do to serve you that will get you to serve me? Meaning, what can I do that will make you happy and get me back here? The goal is to be reelected. That's the goal. The goal is to be reelected. You become a this, you become a that. Your goal is to be reelected back to this or back to that. That's what it is. So they go there and they have to put pork in stuff. They have to do stuff because every once in a while, they got to come back and feed everybody. Every once in a while, they got to come back and say, look what I did. I brought this back to us. I brought this program. I brought this infrastructure thing. I got to do this. They're just as guilty as everywhere else. You know, one of the great guys in politics is Charlie Wilson. He was a Democrat from Texas, right? Who really there's a great book about him, and he spearheaded the war in, really was the one who was the catalyst to Charlie Wilson's war of taking on the Russians via Afghanistan, turning Afghanistan into their Vietnam and essentially bleeding them dry along the way. But you know, the thing is, the reason he was able to do stuff like this, because he was in a district where his people never wanted anything from him because they were pretty highfalutin, right? He held the most IOUs. He played politics better than most people could ever dream of playing politics because he knew he never had to bring anything back. So he could vote on a lot of things. That's what people want. They never expected him to bring anything back. All these people do now is bring more and more debt back. And the Republicans are just as guilty. And when I see the fact that they're thinking about doing something that could raise the deficit, when I see the fact that they're looking at something that could potentially put us further down the road and further in a hole, it pisses me off because they talk the big game, but they rarely walk the big game. Let's tighten the belt. Let's cut some of this stuff. Let's be fiscally conservative. If you're a broker, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your clients. You are a congressperson, you're a senator, you're a president. You have a fiduciary responsibility to the American people. We're in debt to our eyeballs. Enough. The Chad Benson Show, Facebook, at Chad Benson Show. Twitter, ChadBensonShow.com. chad@ChadBensonShow.com. You can text the program, getting some text messages. 323-538-2423, 323-538-2423. Love getting text messages. You can also call us, 844-DIG-CHAT, 844-344-2423. We do it this hour, this time, every day. It's called What's Next. What's next for journalism and news this year under the Trump administration? The Chad Benson Show.
This is going to be easy. Let's see what's next.
I know you're not going to like what I have to say next, but facts are facts.
What's next?
What's next?
What's next?
What's next? We do it every day at this time. We look at what's next. What's next for journalism? We've talked about fake news. What's next for that? What's next for journalism under Trump? And, you know, Trump has said that he likes the laws that Britain have. Britain doesn't have really free speech the way we think of free speech. They have a different, they've got hate speech and a lot of other stuff out there that we would, you know, maybe raise an eyebrow to. One of them is the way they go after journalists over there. And I understand where he's coming from. And look, journalists, I use the word journalist loosely because very few people, I think, are very journalistic anymore. All of them, because of the, well, first and foremost, to get yourself noticed nowadays, you've got to be loud and you have to take on some issues. And for most people, when you take on an issue, you're going to do it from your belief system. And most of the people that go into journalism, whether people want to, you know, out there on the left want to believe this or not, I've worked in many of newsrooms, most of them lean very left. Now, not all of them that comes across, but it's true in the way they cover, especially in the print world, especially in the print world. Journalism's going to have a new foe. Somebody, but by the way, somebody that they have been also championing, because for the last 18 months, their ratings are up, their clicks are up, their views are up, their readership is up because of Donald Trump. And look, don't think that he doesn't realize that. Don't think that he doesn't understand that he has played a big part in their success over the last 18 months. But journalism isn't what it used to be. We look back at the days of Walter Cronkite and a lot of these other guys, and while they were, and Cronkite was, you know, he was a liberal, but you never knew what he was. He was a journalist first and foremost. He presented the news. He brought the news to you. He didn't let his feelings and emotions come through. There wasn't any of that. But we live in a much different world. He didn't have to compete with anything other than the newspapers. Nowadays, you've got to compete with 55 different channels. You've got to compete with everything that's going on online, from vloggers to bloggers to everything else. Journalism isn't what it used to be. Journalism, in many ways, is activism. And what's next this year is it's going to be a fight. Trump is not going to, he's got very thin skin. Let's be first and foremost. His ego is big, and he's got thin skin. And because of his thin-skinnedness, there's going to be some issues here. And there are going to be some fights along the way with journalists. He's going to feel right now, and again, I'm just predicting, wink, wink, like we all know what's going to happen. If you're smart, you can see it. There's going to be fights. There's going to be fights amongst journalists and him. He will single people out. He will come after them. He's going to tweet the hell out of them. He's going to be a journalist in some ways for his own self. And the other side of journalism that is become something that we need to look forward to, or unfortunately forward to, is the propaganda news-ish kind of thing. Not so much the inciting people, but the writing from one side or another. And that's what we got way too much of. But that's on us. Because we as human beings tend to go to places that validate our feelings, that validate our belief systems. We want to hang out with people like that. We hang out with like minds. We want to be around people who are like-minded. We want to watch things that's like-minded. We want to read things that's like-minded. This is what we do. So unfortunately, as much as you could say those kind of fake news propaganda-like stories, that, and many of them, again, are somewhat journalistic, at least in the presentation of them all, we'd like them to go away. They're not going to go away. Because as a person who wants to write and a person who sees that they think they can make a difference or they think they can get their point of view across, they'll use the any means necessary side of things. The one thing about England that he has mentioned in the past, or Britain, is if you knowingly lie in something, meaning if you go and write a story today and you think you have all the facts and this is all that you know and you put it out there and you find out later on down the line that these facts were not to be true or there was things missing from them, you're not going to get popped for that. But in England, if you do that and you knowingly know that they're missing facts, you leave stuff out or you don't add things the way that you should to it, and you knowingly do that to hurt somebody's reputation, you're essentially liable for that. And that's one thing he's talked about. And that's a slippery slope. And journalists are going to fight that tooth and nail. From top to bottom. They had a friend in the White House and somebody that they liked in Barack Obama. They have somebody that they liked the fact that he gets the clicks and the ratings and the whole nine yards, but he's definitely a foe. And it's going to be very interesting to watch what takes place over the next 4 years and how the fights are going to be and how ugly they're going to be. Because he does not go down without a fight. The Chad Benson Show, Facebook, at Chad Benson Show, Twitter, ChadBensonShow.com, chadbensonshow.com. That's what's next for journalism. We're going to talk drugs. W.A. Bogart's going to join us next. We're going to talk about drugs. Should we legalize drugs? Has the war on drugs failed? I say absolutely it has failed. He's got a book. It's coming out now, talking about the legalizations of drugs and whether we should or shouldn't. Could it help? Could it not help? It'll be very interesting. The Chad Benson Show, Facebook, at Chad Benson Show, Twitter, ChadBensonSON, the Chad Benson Show.
Chad Benson Show. Talk radio just got a little cooler.
Chad Benson.
Chad Benson.
The Chad Benson Show.
California, we just legalized the weed. Question is, should we legalize anything else? I know it sounds weird. The war on drugs has failed tremendously. W.A. Bogart joins us now. He's got a new book called Off the Street, Legalizing Drugs. Thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Bogart.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, drugs. You know, the fear factor of drugs in this country and the war on drugs. I think it's safe to say, and I've said it for years, we have failed and the war on drugs is a lost cause. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially that is correct, I'm afraid.
So you've got this thing where we have failed and we've spent God knows how many billions of dollars fighting the war on drugs. Legalization is slowly but surely happening with weed across this country. But you talk about legalization of all drugs. To me, I look at it and I don't have a problem with it. And I think part of that is because I lived in Europe for a while and I've seen what they've done in Portugal and elsewhere. What's the fear factor of legalizing drugs?
Well, I think, you know, it is the fear of unknown. What will happen? Will rates of consumption go up? How will we respond to people who need treatment? How will we protect children from drugs? Because, you know, I think protection of kids is really the first priority. And then there is a kind of streak of law and order that reinforces this notion that the way to go about controlling drugs is through criminalization. So there are a number of factors that hold us back from crossing the line and saying that the war on drugs has been a failure and the only alternative here is careful and gradual move to legalization and regulation. And as you quite rightly pointed out, marijuana is leading the way, both in your country and in Canada. We will, the federal government will introduce legislation this spring to legalize and regulate marijuana throughout Canada. So we're going to learn from marijuana how to go about legalization and regulation. There will be complications that we'll have to address. There are then other incremental steps that we can take. And you referred to Portugal, where 15 years ago, drugs were not legalized and regulated. They were decriminalized. So what that means is people can have a variety of drugs for their personal use and possession without being charged criminally. However, people still have to go to the illicit market to get drugs. The illicit market can still sell adulterated and tainted substances that can make people sick or even kill them. Government is derived from a revenue stream from an industry, and it is an industry, and a full range of harm reduction measures are not available. So my point to you is one of the incremental ways that we could approach other drugs is to first decriminalize them, and then after some experience and really seeing the logic of if we're going to let people have drugs for their personal use, then the logic would seem to be then they ought to be able to obtain them from a source where the drugs won't be tainted, where governments will exercise control and will be able to tax them.
We're talking to W.A. Bogart. His new book's called Off the Streets, Legalizing Drugs. You talked about Portugal. One of the things is they expected a massive, you know, like everything, you don't know what's going to happen in the drug world when you decide to decriminalize them. Not been a huge massive growth as far as drug overdose. It's down and AIDS and a lot of the other things that people thought. Do you think that we would have to decriminalize them? Or, I mean, how do we go about doing that in whether it be California, and, you know, or America, Canada, whatever? How do we go about doing it? Do we take the same method as Portugal or do we do our own method?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm simply pointing to Portugal as one incremental step towards legalization and regulation. But, you know, I think the opioid crisis that we're experiencing in Canada, and I believe that, sadly, many states in the United States are experiencing a similar plague, is also teaching us in Canada about how to move forward in terms of these other drugs. And what I mean by that is we've come to realize that the opioid crisis is really a public health emergency. Very few people are going around saying to people who are using opioids, oh, these people are criminals. They should be prosecuted. They should be thrown in jail. Instead, we're distributing naloxone, which is an opioid inhibitor. We're passing laws, Good Samaritan laws, so that people will not be prosecuted if they call police in the midst of drug taking, if somebody's experiencing an overdose. And we're opening safe injection sites, which are harbors, which allow people to come and inject opioids. And we're doing this because we don't want them to get the terrible infections associated with dirty needles. We don't want them overdosing. We don't want them taking adulterated substances. And the next step that many responsible people are urging is that these safe injection sites would actually hand out the drugs so that we would know that people are getting aren't getting tainted substances. They're getting the kind of drug that they need in any particular circumstances. So my point to you is that although, for example, heroin is still illegal on the books in Canada, the way we're treating the opioid crisis, remember heroin is an opioid, is very much from a public health perspective. And I think it will, despite how horrible it is, it will point the way to a path forward. And a recent poll in Canada that was taken suggests that almost two-thirds of those who are asked are now willing to contemplate legalization and regulation of other drugs other than marijuana.
Why is it that governments are so terrified of legalizing some of these things? Again, I think as a grown adult, anything I do in my home that doesn't harm anybody else should be my kind of, it's my thing. And we've seen in the past, whether it be prohibition or it's where it is now, when you do stuff like this, all you do is open up a market that's bigger for criminals to prosper on.
Well, that's true. I do agree with you. I mean, I think that we come back to this enormous fear of drugs that arose in the 20th century. And, you know, it's very ironic because up until the beginning of the 20th century, drugs were largely unregulated. Laudanum, a mix of opium and alcohol, was taken as a daily pick-me-up. Opium was given to babies to soothe them. Sears Roebuck advertised morphine kits, the better to enjoy the wonder drug. It was only the coming of the 20th century and the opium trade and its association with racist notions about the Chinese, et cetera, to lead to this kind of panic about drugs and what they could do to society. And please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that drugs are always harmless. They can cause enormous harm to individuals. And as we would legalize and regulate them, you know, we would have to take, and we should take measures to engage in what many people refer to as harm reduction, so that you drive down the rates of harmful consumption to the greatest extent possible. But my book, Off the Street, is really a plea for a kind of calm and rational engagement and not a panicked one around the non-medical use of drugs.
Talking to W.A. Bogart, he's got a new book out called Off the Streets, Legalizing Drugs. I'll let you go after this last question. I want to get to you. Where do, let's look out 5-10 years from now, Canada, North America, you know, where do you think we are going to go with drugs? Are we going to one day see in our lifetime that drugs will be either decriminalized across the board and they'll be heavily regulated? Or is this going to be a back and forth tiptoe dance of well, we'll do marijuana in some states and or in Canada, but we're really not going to get to this point where we're going to legalize everything. And because it's a moneymaker, too, for governments in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, I know. I think we will get there. There'll be lots of twists and turns. You know, one advantage that we have in Canada is the criminal law is largely a federal matter. So if we persuade the federal government to move forward, then the drug becomes legalized and regulated throughout the country. But no matter, I mean, I think there are also other complications, like we'll have to see what your Mr. Trump does and his attorney general designate Jeff Sessions in terms of drugs, because, you know, Mr. Sessions is associated with this view that even marijuana is something that shouldn't be legalized and regulated. So there's going to be lots of ups and downs. But as you said in the introduction, the cost of the war on drugs has been such a failure, and the associated costs so great that, yes, I think we will get there. We will see legalization and regulation of drugs over the next quarter century.
His name is W.A. Bogart. His book's called Off the Streets, Legalizing Drug. It's you can pick it up. What bookstores can we get this? Can we get this Amazon and everywhere else?
Amazon and, as they say, at better bookstores everywhere.
Thank you so much. W.A. Bogart's his name. We appreciate that. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Don't Bogart that joint, right? Is that what they would say? Chad, you're wrong. The Chad Benson Show Facebook, at Chad Benson Show Twitter, Chadbenson. Chad at ChadBensonShow.com. You can text the show, 323-538-2423, 323-538-2423. You can also call the program, 844-DIG-CHAD, 844-344-2423. Chad Benson Show.
You're listening to the Chad Benson Show.
Say what, y'all? Say what?
Say what? We're worrying about Russia and North Korea for nothing. We are. We're terrified about this. When in truth, The Walking Dead has it right. The Walking Dead has it right. They've done a new study out of Leicester, University of Leicester, Journal of Physics Special Topics. And they have said, out of this study, after doing the math and some other stuff, that yes, kids, within 100 days, the world would be down to just about 200 people if there was a zombie apocalypse. Think about that. One study assumes that one zombie could affect at least 20 people a day. So they can infect at least 20 people a day. That case would create a horde of zombies that could grow to 190 million people within 100 days. And we were sitting there and we were talking about this today. Like, well, how could this even? There's no way. But think about it. Eventually, you're going to run out of ammo. You're going to run out of places to hide. And even if you're hiding somewhere, you're going to run out of food. So you have to get to a place that that's geographically somewhat safe. An island would probably be the best. Because zombies aren't going to take boats to your island. That's just not going to happen, right? They're not going to swim to your island. They're not taking boats to your island. So geographically, you have to get to somewhere that is going to allow you to continue to have food, continue to have water, potentially you can get some ammunition. That's the best way to survive. Outside of that, you're screwed. But we're worrying about the little dude in North Korea, and we're worrying about Putin, right? No, worry about zombies. Say, what? Oh, yeah. I like it. I think it's kind of cool. If you make great money, why buy a car? Why even lease a car when you can do a subscription agreement with Cadillac? Cadillac's going to launch a $1,500 a month luxury car subscription service. Here's the thing that's great about it, right? Yeah, it's not cheap, right? It's $1,500 a month. So it's not cheap. It's not for the cheap. But I think this is a test. Over the year, you can change the car out 18 times. You don't pay for insurance except to cover yourself, not the car. Because the car, if something happens to it, you will have to pay a $750 deductible. But over the course of a year, you can change out the car 18 times. That's pretty awesome. So members can keep a single model for up to 60 continuous days, but then they eventually need to change their car. This year's got new Escalade model, starts about 100 G's. The new CT6 starts at 54 grand. I've seen that thing. It's awesome. I love this. And they're saying, look, this is the way a younger generation is going to look at stuff because they've got all these ride-sharing programs. People don't want to be tied to one thing, and they don't really want to own anything, and it's a good thing. And I think if this is somewhat successful, don't be surprised that other car manufacturers don't fall in suit and do something similar on a more manageable kind of price point. It's the way subscription agreements, kids. This is what it is. Finally, President Trump will be the richest president in U.S. history. We've got the top 10 people who aren't President Trump. Kennedy, whose net worth was $1 billion, ranks at the bottom because the family fortune is mostly what it is. He didn't directly own it, but the Kennedy families are worth $1 billion. But he still had some cash. Roosevelt was worth about $66 million. Much of his wealth was inherited. Bill Clinton, about $75 million. Herbert Hoover, $82 million. Number six, Lyndon B. Johnson, about $100 million. Not bad. James Madison, all them cupcakes, worth about $112 million. Andrew Jackson. Oh, yeah. Andrew Jackson got wealthy because of land speculation. He's worth about $131 million. He comes in at number four. Number three, Teddy Roosevelt. His net worth today would be about $138 million. He was the 26th president. He was born into wealth in New York City and made even more money from valuable and smart real estate investing. Numero dos. Thomas Jefferson, that's right, had a wealth of $234 million. Just like other presidents, he inherited a huge, vast real estate fortune, of which he was very smart with. but number one pre-Trump. And I cannot tell a lie. He was a land speculator. He was also the first of our presidents. He was worth, on estimate, about $580 million. So, and we think that back in the day that all of these politicians gave and gave and gave, and they did it all for free, and they weren't men of wealth and power, I think we could look back on this and said, yeah, they did okay. $580 million, that's huge. Trump, obviously, depending on who you believe, $3 billion to $10 billion. That's a lot more than these guys. In fact, you can put them all together. They're not worth what he's worth. But, hey, you know what? Success, kids. Nothing wrong with success. The Chad Benson Show Facebook, at Chad Benson Show Twitter, C-H-A-D-B-E-N-S-O-N, Chad at ChadBensonShow.com. You can text the show, 323-538-2423. We've got a poll on Twitter, a couple of them. Do you really care about what Hollywood has to say? 92% of you say no, shut up and act. That's kind of funny. Check it out at Chad Benson Show. That's your Twitter poll for the day.
The Chad Benson Show.